Last week we began our look at the second half of Daniel by focusing on Daniel 7. And you remember that I mentioned that Daniel 7 is the most important chapter in Daniel and among the most important chapters in all of the Bible. I realize that's saying a lot. You remember that Daniel 7 is a transition chapter. It's a transition that connects the first half of the book of Daniel with the second half of the book of Daniel. Daniel 7 is the last chapter written in Aramaic, tying it to the chapters that precede it. It's also apocalyptic in style, connecting it to the final chapters in Daniel, which are written in the same style. You know, there are other connection points as well. In Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about a statue that's made of four types of metal, the last being iron mixed with clay. Daniel reveals that these four types of metals were empires, each with their own characteristics. In Daniel 7, we have four beasts, each with their own characteristics that correspond to Daniel's interpretation of the king's dream in chapter 2. So we have this connection between chapter 2 and chapter 7. In Daniel 6, you have Daniel, who in chapter 8 will become, or be called, the Son of Man, facing death by being thrown into a pit of lions, which are hungry beasts with pointy teeth and sharp claws, in case you didn't know. In Daniel 7, you have four beasts representing the Gentile empires coming out of the sea. And the sea, in Jewish thought, represents chaos and evil. The fourth beast speaks against the Most High and opposes his holy people, we're told, in verse 25. In fact, we're told that the holy people will be delivered to the fourth beast into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. Now, Daniel 7 is clear that these beasts represent empires and their leaders, particularly empires that stand in opposition to the Lord Most High and his people. Now, here's a question for you. Why the image of beasts? Now, particularly mutant beasts, these unnatural hybrids. I mean, I get it, beasts are scary, especially beasts coming out of the dark, turning, chaotic sea, but still, why beasts? You know, is it a combination of late night pizza and his ordeal in the lion's den that has Daniel dreaming about beasts? Well, no, because Daniel 7 begins by telling us that Daniel had this dream in the first year of King Belshazzar, which is 10 years before the events of Daniel 5. And so this dream is way before the lion's breath ever steamed up Daniel's glasses. But at the same time, we should realize that this isn't a mistake that Daniel places this dream where he does. Think about it. Daniel purposely pulls this dream out of the chronology of the first part of this book and places it after, immediately after his ordeal in the lion's den. And if Daniel is purposely messing with the chronology, it's because he wants us to notice something. He wants us to make a connection between what he's experienced personally in chapter 6 and the message of his dream in chapter 7. In other words, Daniel is making a connection between the beasts that he was thrown to and the beasts that stand in opposition to the holy ones, the people of God. Ultimately, he wants us to understand that even though God's people are in exile and seemingly without control over their circumstances, and even though they too may be thrown to the beasts for time, times, and half a time, they will find final and everlasting victory before Yahweh, the Lord Most High. It's a call to be faithful then, and to continue to trust Yahweh, even when the clouds remain. But there's more. Daniel describes the first beast with these words. The first was a lion, like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. This is verse 4. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being. And the mind of a human was given to it. Now, last week we talked about the first beast representing Babylon as well as Nebuchadnezzar. You know, the image of this beast is very popular in this culture. Now, here's the question for you. Think about Daniel 4 for a moment. Nebi, because of his arrogance, becomes a beast, right? In chapter 4. Verse 33 tells us, immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. Then after 7 periods of time, Nebuchadnezzar is humbled and he praises Yahweh and his sanity is returned. And once again, he has the mind of a man. So there's a clear connection between Nebuchadnezzar and what happens in Daniel 4 with the image God gives Daniel in his dream in chapter 7. When we read the description of the first beast in chapter 7, we're expected to recall the events of chapter 4 and Yahweh's humbling of Nebuchadnezzar. We're also to remember that Nebuchadnezzar becomes a beast. Are you following me? Seeing all these connections being made by Daniel and seeing all the details coming from Daniel's apocalyptic dream really gives us some depth of understanding here. Nebuchadnezzar is a man who becomes a beast. Why? We don't have to guess. We're told specifically because of his arrogance. It's because he looked at everything that God had given him and considered it a reflection on his own goodness, his own skills, his own rule, his own wisdom, his own power for his own glory. Now, instead of seeing himself as a steward of the rule God had given him, which Daniel has already pointed out, by the way, he took credit for everything himself. In his independent, arrogant celebration of his own power and accomplishment, he became a beast. He no longer thought as a human. He no longer was like a human. And his life becomes a lived-out parable of what happens when a human being, when an image bearer, no longer represents the one whose image they bear. There's a few other connections to make here. In Daniel 3:1, Nebuchadnezzar has a golden statue built on the plain of Duma in Babylon. Now, underline the word plain there. In Genesis 11:2, we read, as people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. The plain of Shinar is Babylon. And what happened there? Verse 4. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Let's make a name for ourselves. Isn't that exactly what Nebi was doing with the statue? Isn't that exactly the attitude that got him on all fours chewing his cud? Yeah. What about the last part of 4? Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. What's that about? Does that remind you of anything? Is that a thread that goes back to the beginning? I think it is. In Genesis 1, we read about God's intention for humanity. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, in case you didn't get the point. He created them male and female. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth and subdue it. God creates humanity, both male and female, in his own image. What does it mean to be made in God's image? An image represents the interests and the authority of the ones whose image it bears. It's a placeholder for the one whose image it bears. An image represents the real thing and the interests of the real thing. Think back to Daniel 3. When Nebuchadnezzar sets up this image that represents him, and he makes the decree that all the leaders throughout the entire empire would come and worship the image. Why? It was a move to unify the country. It was a move to solidify his rule, because to bow down to the image was to acknowledge Nebuchadnezzar's authority and power. It was to declare loyalty to his rule and his interests as part of his kingdom. That's exactly the idea behind human beings being created in God's image. As God's image bearers, we're to represent the interests and the authority and the rule of God in this world. That's why we're given the rule over the beasts and the creatures and the rest of creation. Not to abuse it, not to take advantage of it, but to take care of it as God's representatives. And that's why we're commanded to multiply and fill the earth. They were to take God's image and fill the earth with it and expand his reign and his rule. That was the intention. But what happens in chapter 3? We kind of know. A beast, a serpent, a shining one, the word means. Who is a beast, but who's more than a beast? Works the angles and plays to the desires of them wanting to rule on their own behalf and in their own way. So instead of representing the God whose image they bore, they took their cues from the snake and started to act like beasts. Now go back to chapter 11 of Genesis. Notice the desired result of settling in Babylon and building this tower, reaching to heaven. In a way, declaring their own divine status. The reason they did this was so they wouldn't be scattered. Unfortunately, what happened? They were scattered. That's the way it goes. They wouldn't be scattered. In other words, the reason they did this was so that they wouldn't be scattered. It was a direct challenge to God's command to fill the earth. Instead of filling the earth, they wanted to stay in one place. It's a direct challenge to being image bearers. It's a direct challenge to being human beings, at least as God intended them to be human beings. And all of this happened on the plain of Babylon. Are you seeing how Babylon becomes a type? A stand-in for those who band together and oppose God in their own independent arrogance. And in so doing, they become like beasts. I know that's a lot of information. It's a big picture, about as big as the picture gets. But once you see it, once you see how the story threads throughout Scripture, all the way to Babylon the Great in Revelation, you can't miss this story that is so powerful, in which God is active and moving. Let's take a break from the beast. And let's look at the other figures in Daniel 7 for a moment. You know, we have the Ancient of Days. We know who that is, right? God the Father. And we have one like the Son of Man. Now remember last week we learned that the term Son of Man is just a Hebrew way of saying human being. So we have one like a human being, and we have the Ancient of Days, God the Father. Starting in verse 9, there's an abrupt change in Daniel 7. Things shift dramatically. The focus shifts from the beasts to the heavenly courtroom, where judgment is declared and carried out on the fourth beast. Immediately after that, Daniel writes, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a man, like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence." Now, this being was like the Son of Man. He was like a human. But he was coming with the clouds of heaven, which is a clear allusion to his divinity. No, this is a theophany. Like I said last week, if the Son of Man isn't also God, it would be the only time in over 70 passages where the coming on the clouds didn't refer to a divine being. So we have a divine being like a Son of Man, appearing to be a human being. Of course, we have this fleshed out literally in the New Testament, right? Meanwhile, so you have someone like a Son of Man appearing to be a human being. Meanwhile, you have human beings and the rebellious, violent, prideful, arrogant empires becoming like beasts. Don't miss the irony or the significance. We become like beasts, so God has to become like us in order to fix it. Finally, we have human beings who's going to be, you know, faithfully carrying out the Ancient of Days command to be an image bearer. Look at verse 14. This is what he does. This is what's given to him. This is how he's capable of carrying it out in such a grand and perfect way. He was given authority and glory and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. This one, like the Son of Man, will be the perfect image bearer, as the perfect ruler and authority. Finally, a kingdom that will fill the earth and represent the interests of Yahweh. Right? See that? And what is this one like the Son of Man? You know, the one thing we do know is that whatever he does is final and eternal. I should give you a clue. Remember, in the context of Daniel 7, the coming of the one that's like the Son of Man happens in conjunction with the judgment of the arrogant fourth beast. You know, it's arrogant fourth beast is thrown into the fire and destroyed, and then you have the ascension of the one like the Son of Man who is given authority, given the kingdom. So the ascension of the one like the Son of Man is also the judgment of the beast. Just like when Daniel is brought up out of the pit, when he's ascending out of the pit, so to speak, those who accused him were judged and destroyed and thrown into the pit. That's the image of vindication, is it not? Now, last week I mentioned the title Son of Man is by far Jesus' preferred way of describing himself. I mean, it's not close, you know. Number two is nowhere near this one. Son of Man is used 81 times in the Gospels to refer to Jesus. So we understand that Jesus saw himself, his ministry, his purpose, and his place in God's big picture through the lens of Daniel 7. That's why this is such an important chapter. If you want to know how Jesus saw himself, look at Daniel 7. Daniel 7 is a window into the mind and the motivation of Christ. This is why we're spending another week looking at the message of Daniel 7. Daniel in general, and Daniel 7 in particular, is a place to dig in and to find hope. To have it revealed to us a little bit more of the glory that is Christ and the plan of salvation. But let's take a minute and look at a key moment in Jesus' life and see how he connects Daniel 7 to what's going on. It's a powerful passage. Matthew 26. Jesus has just been arrested and he's now before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council. He's standing before Caiaphas, the high priest, the head honcho, the representative of God. We're told that Caiaphas and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence so that they could put Jesus to death. But they couldn't find anything, although finally they had two witnesses declare, "No, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days." Pretty loose comment on what Jesus was saying. Doesn't exactly sound like death penalty evidence, does it? Starting with verse 62, we read, "Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, 'Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?' But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, 'I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God.'" Let's stop there for a moment. Jesus remained silent. Like the servant in Isaiah 53, he was opposed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. You know, really, what is there to say? They weren't interested in Jesus defending himself. The purpose was to get rid of him. Still, they wanted the trial to look somewhat kosher, I guess we could say. And so the high priest forces him and forces the issue by using his right as high priest to compel Jesus to speak, by charging him under oath by the living God. You know, this is, you have to talk, otherwise you're breaking the law. If Jesus refuses to speak, he was in fact sinning. The high priest bluntly asks this very question that's been on everyone's lips and been murmuring all through Jerusalem. "Tell us if you're the Messiah, the Son of God." Now Jesus has to say something. What's he going to say? He says something in the typical way that Jesus does. "You have said so," replied Jesus. I'm not sure he said it that way, but "You have said so. But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." You have said so. What does Jesus mean by that? Well, he's saying yes. But he's saying it in a way that leaves the words of the high priest in the high priest's mouth. Like a kind of a backhanded compliment, so to speak. You see, the problem that Jesus had was he knew the high priest didn't understand exactly what was meant by both Messiah and the Son of God. He had both of those things wrong. So it was difficult for him just to be in full agreement and to be all bubbly about it. He had the right words, but not the right meaning. You know, this was more of an image of the Messiah being a political leader, someone trying to build an empire against Rome. It was someone interested in bringing violence and revolt and uprising. Someone fighting beasts by being beasts. And Jesus had nothing to do with that. That's not what his Messiah was about. That's not what being the Son of God was about. So, with this popular version of the Messiah and why the Messiah came floating around in the high priest's head and in the culture's head, Jesus leaves the words in the high priest's mouth. But he still affirms the statement. But then he qualifies the statement by declaring exactly who he was. "But I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Now, I've quoted here from the TNIV, the 2011 version of the NIV, because it corrects a less accurate translation that was in the older version of the NIV that's in the congregation here. You know, in the NIV, the phrase "from now on" was translated "in the future." The translators made a judgment call indicating that they thought Jesus was talking about his return. But that's not what's going on. Jesus is not talking about his return. To speak about the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven again points back to Daniel 7:14. The image there isn't when someone returning from heaven to earth. It's someone ascending to heaven and being vindicated. It's about the Son of Man receiving from the Ancient of Days authority. Glory. And sovereign power. And that's what happens. After Jesus' death on the cross and his resurrection, we read, you know this, then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you, and surely I am with you always till the very end of the age. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Jesus is once again quoting from Daniel 7:14. And what's he saying? Jesus is saying that at his resurrection, he was vindicated. And his reign began. At this point of his resurrection, the Ancient of Days has given him authority and glory and sovereign power. Right then, right there. In Colossians, Paul makes this interesting comment about the cross. He says, and having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Once again, we have the language of vindication. He triumphs over the powers and the authorities. He disarms them. He takes away their power and shows them to be ridiculous beasts. And he does it by the cross. The point of Daniel 7:14 is talking about Jesus ascending. It's about vindication. And Jesus in Matthew 26 is speaking to a power and authority. In fact, he's speaking to the religious head honcho of power and authority, the high priest, and he quotes Daniel 7:14. In this moment, when he seems powerless, when he is about to face death, and the authorities are about to devour him like beasts in a lion's den, Jesus looks at the high priest and says, you're going to see my vindication. You're going to see my kingdom come. You're attempting to try to strip my authority away. It's only going to give me the ultimate authority from the Ancient of Days. It's going to backfire on you. From the human perspective, Jesus is the lamb led to the slaughter. But from Yahweh's perspective, Jesus was receiving his throne at the right hand of the Father. This is what's in Jesus' mind as he speaks to Caiaphas. This is what he declares. He is the divine one who is like the Son of Man. He is the one who through the cross and the resurrection will be given authority and glory and sovereign power in all peoples and nations and men of every language worshiping him. His dominion will be an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom will be one that will never be destroyed. This is how Jesus clarifies Caiaphas' statement about being the Messiah. Some clarification. And he knows that the high priest knows exactly what he's doing here. Daniel was a very key and important book at this time in the history of Israel, ever since the 2nd century, ever since the Maccabees. You know, it wasn't about Rome, is what he was saying here. It's about every beastly empire since the Tower of Babel. It's about vindication. It's about establishing an eternal kingdom. It's about all peoples and nations and men of every language worshiping him. And here's the point I really want you to see. This isn't just about worldly empires. It's about the beast within. It's about our own empires of pride and arrogance and rebellion built upon our own beastly self-rule. This is about us listening to the serpent in the garden. This is about each of us. You see, Jesus, in quoting from Daniel 7:14, wasn't just revealing his own identity. He was also revealing the identity of Caiaphas, the high priest. If Jesus is the one like the Son of Man coming on the clouds, that made Caiaphas and his opposition and his assumed authority over Jesus, it made him the beast. And he knew that. And you now know what this means. It means that we're all beasts. We all oppose God's rule. We are all creators of chaos. Just look in my office. Right? We all have claws and teeth that we bear as part of this dog-eat-dog world sometimes. We all want to make a name for ourselves. We all want to build our own towers. We're all worthy of judgment. Even if we grew up in a godly home and have dedicated our lives to serving God like Caiaphas did. Because no one's good enough. You need to face the beast. I need to face the beast. But there's more here. Remember what we learned from Daniel 7 last week. In verse 26, regarding the fourth beast, we read, "But the court will sit, and his power," referring to the fourth beast, "will be taken away and completely destroyed forever." No more problem. "Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him." Surprise ending. You expect the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heavens to be handed over to the man who's like the Son, or the one who's like the Son of Man. But it isn't. It's handed over to the saints, the holy ones of God, the holy people of God. And yet, it's called his kingdom. And his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom. And all will obey him. Well, which is it? Is it his kingdom or the kingdom of the saints, the people of the Most High? The answer is yes. Or as Jesus would have said, it is as you say. On the cross and through the resurrection, Jesus himself isn't the only one who finds vindication. So do we. But our vindication isn't from the beast. Well, it is in a way. It's vindication for ourselves from the judgment of God. We are in Christ. We're his people. We're his body. To put it in terms of the message today, we are now, as his followers, truly his image bearers. We can and will fill the earth and rule the earth as his representatives, according to his interest, according to his love and his peace. And yes, this reality is not complete. It's still future, but it's also here now. The vindication, the ascension of Jesus was his inauguration. It was the beginning of what is yet to be completed at his return. But the point is that it's here. And just as Caiaphas saw Jesus' vindication as the news of Jesus' resurrection and his ascension spread and the people came into the church, we will see Jesus' completed vindication at his return. When every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. What this means is that for now, you live in a place of vindication, but not complete victory. This is the place of the yet and the not yet. It's the place of vindication, but there's still a battle. In this place called Babylon, we are to remain faithful people of the exile. But we're also to recognize and face the beast within. We can now be real human beings because of the power of the one who is like a human being, the one who is like a son of man, because he's in us. So trust him. Be faithful to him. Live for him. What else is there to live for? Resist the Babylon that surrounds you and sometimes finds its life within you. Remember the vindicated one, the ascended one, the one who has all authority has also promised to be with us until the very end of the age. Worship team.